Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren. On
Los Angeles. 102.3 FM Riverside.
And 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Joe Goldberg is in the house again.
I'm here for you, Al. I'm here for you.
Well, listen, today we've got a returning guest. Not necessarily returning for exactly what he was here last time for. Last time, I believe he was talking about Shadow Masters Reloaded, which is a more of a action suspense thriller type novel. And now, you know, maybe even dark fiction, depending on who you talk to. But now he's decided to add to his vast array of books. And now he's got a new one out that's considered horror. And that's Whispers of a Gypsy. So welcome, JT, and how are you doing?
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me back, and I am doing well.
So this was, for me, this isn't what I expected out of you, because, I mean, you know, I've interviewed you, and we've talked and all that, and I see you on social media and that. So I didn't really notice anything like this coming, and all of a sudden it was here. Are a lot of people surprised you did this?
I think so. And I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing or not. I had finished my series that I was under contract for of Task Force Orange series. And, I finished that right before COVID. And there were some things about the contract I didn't love. I was under still the responsibility to submit all of my work to CIA and DOD, and that takes a lot of time, and it was making it difficult to meet some deadlines for publishing. And there was an aspect of really them just not wanting me to continue on the subject that I was doing, which was this more of a signals intelligence thing. So about that time during COVID, you know, my son was asking me if he could read any of my books, and, you know, the answer was no, they were just too dark. Language was horrible. And he said, could you write me one? And I said, sure. And so he gave me some of the criteria that that he was hoping I could include in a book. And, you know, 2 years later, it took on a kind of a life of its own. And, you know, out popped this this horror book. And I thought, while I was writing it, it was really pretty liberating, because I no longer had to worry about ammunition, the type of gun, the range, all of that detail. And of course, then the regulations, you know, that I had to work within. It was just, you know, write the story. And I really enjoyed what I was doing. And I think it also played to a lot of what I read, which is a lot of Thomas Harris, Stephen King, a little bit more in that suspense and psychological fiction and even horror.
Why do you think some people would be not so happy that you've surprised them with this horror?
Well, I don't think that it's, you know, an anger in any really, you know, I'm not a million copy writer either. So it's not like I just disrupted a whole, you know, readership. I think that many of the people who are looking for specific military thriller and espionage could get a little bit annoyed with some of the supernatural aspect in this one, even though it does have some aspect of espionage to it, and a little bit of the military side. So I think that it's really more about the purists that could be like, oh, this isn't really my bag. I wish he wouldn't have done something like that. But again, for the amount of readers that I actually have that are buying books, I don't think that it's anything that's too concerning. But I'm just hoping people recognize it for what it is. That's a specific different group than, or series of books than what this new one is.
Yeah, I'm sure all 5-6 readers won't mind.
That's exactly right.
But yeah. I was going to say, but why not use a pseudonym, you know, like a different name for this type a book, just in case, like just separate it, you know, call yourself TJ.
You know, you're not too far off. Actually, there was a couple agents and publishers that had recommended that. And I suppose that if I really wanted to just start over, I could do it. But I think in this case, even though it is a separate genre, if you look at some of the books that I had written, still that dark fiction, still that same type of a tone, still that kind of a gray decision-making process, they're really all the same. So I think I was willing to take a bet, you know, roll the dice a little bit on this one and keep the name, because ultimately if I end up moving more into this space or, you know, even shifting around, it's still the same type of work that I'm doing. It's not like I'm writing all of a sudden this, you know, happy young adult or a children's book in a totally different tone. It's still the same pace, the same feelings, that same kind of brooding, hanging over cloak that goes into this writing that I think people are, I think, coming to me to read, which is different from any other type of like the military thriller or espionage. So if they like what they're reading with me and they're following me, it could be just because of that type of a tone that I am using in my writing. And that's what I'm hoping to just continue on, because that's me. That's my style.
Yeah, I read it. It's a great book. So you just gave me the similarities. I can see the darkness, and we'll get maybe more into the plot and things like that, but it's, you know, it's heavy, it's dark, it's horror, like the military stuff, the action stuff. What's different? What was different from writing espionage, thriller, action to horror? And how'd you do it? What is your research process or something?
I think in this one, it was a lot more about the, a little bit of a family structure, a little bit more about society. Certainly there's, you know, one of the main characters, Dwight, who's a 12-year-old child. There is a detective that is a person of color and has gone through some social issues herself, and that she's trying to deal with and navigate even in this kind of closed Jewish society that she's operating in. So there's a lot more, I don't know that it's necessarily cultural, but there were certainly a lot of sensitivities. This book, more than any other book, I had at least a dozen sensitivity readers, because it is so vast. It can deal with people of color. It can deal with the Romani, which is what it centers on. You know, we call them gypsies, but, you know, that's a disparaging term. And so to understand, you know, how you can use that appropriately without offending other people. There's the Jewish element, and there's a part of it where when you're looking at the conservative Jewish family, how there is an element of some abuse that you never hear about. So how you can deal with that without it coming off as anti-Semitic, when the whole message is to counter the anti-Semitism and talk about hate. So it's really difficult, I think, to navigate some of those things where you want to cast a little bit of light into some areas, but, you know, being an other in almost all of these cases, I think it was hard to do. And I think that, you know, the other fine line that I had to walk was about appropriation. misappropriation, you know, and taking that voice from people. And so I had to be really sensitive to, you know, be authentic as I could in a storyteller without it really being my story, if that makes sense.
Yeah. When you're doing kind of even the other style of book, don't you have to kind of go through the same sort of sensitivities in a way, because you're dealing with, you know, with espionage or crime or thrillers and stuff, and you're also involving other countries?
I think I worried about it a lot less. I wasn't worried about offending Iran as a country as a whole. You know, when I was talking about some of their military actions and things of that nature, I think the only thing I had to worry sometimes about was, you know, sometimes in military thrillers, you often find that a lot of the far right or conservatives might go towards those a little bit more than, say, you know, far left leaning. And so sometimes you just want to balance that a little bit if you don't want to get too preachy or you don't want to get too sensitive or too woke, you know, that type of thing. But I just always felt like what I wrote was what I wrote. And I didn't worry too. I was more worried about what I couldn't disclose or expose than it was sensitivities of any individuals, groups, peoples, et cetera, as much. Maybe I should have.
Well, hey, JT, have you gotten anybody comments back from anybody, positive or negative? Hopefully positive, constructive on those topics.
I would say so. There was a large group of Jewish horror writers that I submitted to first, and they were like, "I see nothing wrong with this." Because I also wanted to make sure that as there's a very small segment where I actually am describing a part of the concentration camp where some of these experiments were, but I try not to make the book that at all. So it was just this very sliver to give a little bit of context. And I wanted to make sure that nothing was being exploited for horror sake and for shock factor as much as that was just part of the atmosphere in that situation. So I think from that standpoint, but I'd say people were really pretty forgiving and they liked that, you know, how it was done, because it was being authentic to show there are some really horrific things done. From individuals that had, you know, Roma backgrounds, they thought there are some that didn't like the word gypsy being used in any sense. And I suspect that was part of, you know, just like using the N word, R words, you know, just, there's just kind of a line. But I actually talked to the Auschwitz Museum, Poland, and a number of people, and I asked, why are you still using the word gypsy? And they said, well, because that's how people are recognizing it. And if we talked about it as Romani, not necessarily the same amount of people would recognize that we're talking about the same group of people. And so when I even went with the title of Whispers of a Gypsy, I initially had it as Whispers of a Stranger, and the feedback I was getting from publishers and agents were, it's really not very provocative in that we don't know what you're talking about. And so I did consciously make that decision to use it to draw in a little bit more of that awareness. And I hope I did the right thing, because again, I don't, anything that anybody said, that's a little iffy, I took out. There was one part about, I think there was something in like, some jargon I had used, and someone's like, that's really not necessary because we already know who this individual is and what's going on. And so we don't want to reinforce something. So that type of stuff was really helpful. I think similar to the, sensitivity readers, I used about four different editors. Also, I used one from Berkeley, Education. I used one that was a British editor. Then I used somebody that was from horror. Then I actually used a horror writer. So I was getting a whole lot of different perspectives also on language use, structuring the sentence, et cetera, so that I was putting this story together to be representative of everything I was hoping it would be. So it took a lot of real engineering, so to speak.
Well, talk about that. What is the difference in writing the horror stuff versus your previous books?
So
stylistically.
Yeah. So good question. And I think that's also an area that I try to be very conscious of. So as much as I'm part of the International Thriller Writers Association, I'm also part of the Horror Writers Association, and I've been a juror in the past for their Bram Stoker Award in a number of different categories. So at any point in time in a year, I'm reading about 70, 80, maybe 90 books to help judge and to make the recommendations of the ones that we want to put forward. And I, in reading a number of those and seeing what didn't work, I also tried to engineer what would work. And I felt like to grasp a reader, and this is true of really any book, the first three chapters or four chapters have to be very, very compelling to bring them in. You know, now it's what Amazon might provide as a sample. In the past, it could have been at Barnes and Noble's, what you could read in about 5 minutes. So I tried to construct that very tight so that it was compelling, suspenseful, bring the reader in. I think that's very similar to what we do in the thriller side. The other aspect of it is I do feel that there's a number of different camps in horror as to what people want to see and what they don't want to see and where they usually have the biggest complaints. And the one biggest complaint that I saw was it was a good story, but it took a long time to get into it, or it got me into it and then it kind of petered off. And I thought that what I could bring from the thriller side was a little bit faster pace and tempo, really watching that tempo in the character arcs, even if there were multiple. And I think having a little bit more structure to how that was mechanically put for a thrill ride of having your peaks, having your valleys, having your midpoints, and having something else so that you're leaving almost each chapter as a cliffhanger. I felt that that was very, very helpful. And as I see a lot of horror writers today, there are, you know, those that are writing more about those haunted houses, and there's some that are about the vampires. And I find that a lot of the writing can be very, very casual. Let's kind of see where it goes. I'm not sure how many are really structuring their novels to really understand where they have the reader, where they need to keep the reader, where they can let them go, where they don't need so much exposition. And I think so a lot of lessons learned from both the genres and then both as reading just a massive amount and recognizing, okay, what's going to get, you know, brought forward for an award and which are those that are kicked to the curb.
So what is the basic premise of this book?
So in this book, what we have is there's a Mr. Mortimer is the, he's definitely the anti-hero. And he was a victim of the Holocaust and a lot of genetic testing. I guess we might look at it from that superhuman standpoint. He was exploited to hunt Nazis, and I don't, without giving too much away, that's part of, you know, his job, but that's not the premise of the book so much as like he's finishing that. Now he's done his duty 75 years later, you know, most of the Nazis are gone. How is he going to live his life? And through, you know, a happenstance situation, he's brought in with his family that he has some blood ties to from the Romani community, and finds this boy who's mentally challenged. His mom's being abused, he's being abused, and he becomes a bit of a protector. In the meantime, you know, Mr. Mortimer's past is catching up to him. Secrets are being divulged. And so those kind of come crashing in. So he's having to both protect himself and then also this boy. And I think what we see is just a lot of recurring themes of, you know, those intersection points of why people are really after Mr. Mortimer, or why people are after Dwight, the young boy. And a lot of it revolves around, you know, that hate, that fear, the uncertainty, the otherness of people. And it comes into then, you know, a lot of nurture versus nature. You know, are people born with that type of a hate? Is there a certain pureness? And I think that's one of the things that we really highlight with Dwight's characters, his pureness, even though he's got some disabilities, just that unconditional love that he has for people. And I used a bit of a trope here where Dwight could kind of see or sense auras of people. And so he wouldn't see people for their color, so to speak, you know, the race as we would think of it, but he sees them for their human color, you know, their yellows, their reds, because he can sense their heart. But Dwight, you know, seeing his surroundings around him, you know, he wants to change. He wants to be, you know, quote unquote normal. And because of the types of genetic capabilities that Mr. Mortimer has and how he can regenerate and stuff, you know, there's an interest in him being that super power type person. And if he does have that, what's going to change? And I think that's a lot of what I am hoping to bring to the reader is, you know, to think about those things. But in the meantime, there's some pretty harrowing stuff, and I hope to, you know, scare the hell out of people too for a good, you know, thrill ride.
Well, what brought you to write this story? And I don't mean horror in itself. I just see that there's quite a bit of meaning to this story, to you, and what you're putting down here and what you're talking about. The subtext is almost the driver in the story. So, was there a reason you went to this type of a story?
Yeah, I think there was. I think, I think all of my writing are, you know, a little bit cathartic in one way or another. And, I did grow up in a neighborhood that was, very mixed, predominantly Jewish, with a lot of Holocaust survivors. Everybody just kind of was very accepting. That being said, I was bullied, quite a bit in my young age. Not for any particular reason, just because I was, you know, that person downhill. And there was another guy who was, you know, further down the hill that, I was a bully to. And, actually that's who I dedicated this to. He's since passed. But a kid that I went to his bar mitzvah for, and nothing that I, you know, ever bullied him over was for, being anti-Semitic. It was just, you know, the weaker type of a person. And, but yeah, he was really a good individual. So I think there's a lot of reflection on just, you know, how we bully people, why we bully people, and that can be interpreted or misinterpreted as hate. At the same time, there's a lot going on, you know, in this world that's around us. My wife is Indian. My kids are mixed. So I see a different side of that sometimes even than others do. And yet, because I'm not, I miss a lot also. So I think that was part of it. I think you just kind of reflect on what's going on with the world around you at the time. And I think that, you know, as I continue to keep opening up my heart and hoping other people do the same, you know, you read the news and you find that there's so many people that are, you know, not so, and the rise of, you know, more of the Nazi movement and acceptances for hate and discrimination and racism and stuff like that. You just wish it would go away and it doesn't. So there's, I think, so much of the question of, is it only rearing its head because of social media and certain political players in place and, you know, mouthpieces out there? Or, you know, is there something that's stirring it more back up? And so I think as I'm doing some of those reflection, I wanted, you know, throw in some little pieces too for people to think about, but yet not to be so overt where it's like a preachy type of a thing. I just wanted it to come kind of organically, maybe for some reflection.
Well, I mean, like I say, I've read it, and there are a lot of themes, I will say culture, thematic elements. I can almost see this being a textbook, a book to read in a school. Is that anything in your mind as you were putting this together, something that people would read?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I've got three kids, two of which are in college and one of them's in high school. All of them thrive in environments where they're reading a book that they can discuss in class. And there's no right or wrong answers. You know, it's just kind of talking about those various themes. I did make a conscious effort to not use a lot of foul language like I would have in the past. I think there's only one F-bomb in there, and I wanted it to be in there just so it would sound so much louder. But yeah, I think that I thought this could be the type of book that you could bring into a junior or senior level classroom, for high school, or even like a freshman, reading class in college, because I thought it's a great topic for debate. I think it's awesome for book clubs. There's just a lot that you can talk about and maybe never arrive at a conclusion, but just to have discussion. I think that's what I really intended for it to be. Is it's a starting point for some discussion. But in the meantime, you know, still gives those thrills that it keeps you wanting to read it.
Well, have you thought about creating your own reader's guide and putting that out with the book, and maybe that will generate some educators to take a look at it?
I never even thought about a reader's guide to it. And quite honestly, with, you know, how it came about, I don't know that it has the uptake or swell yet, to generate that type of an interest. I found that in going to a lot of publishers, it was kind of some really unique feedback where people would say, this is a really timely book, but I don't think you're the person to tell it. I had other people to say, I was not of the same type of characters. And so I think there was another side of it, which was, this is a little bit too provocative for us to take on. And so when I ended up going with a smaller press that was just, they believed in it and they thought this was very timely, especially, you know, this is set in Skokie, Illinois. So, an area that is still dealing with a lot of anti-Semitism and, graffiti and stuff and just, you know, hate talk and that, it's happening right now. And so the idea was, let's just get this out into the wild right now for people to read. So there isn't a whole lot of marketing push behind it. And so I think that, you know, as we talk about what could potentially come about for, you know, school or something like that, again, it's got to organically grow, I think, because I just don't have all the resources to continue to push it out into the market like a big publisher would.
Did you have any problems getting into the minds of the bad characters, the ones that do have problems with, you know, people that they don't see as themselves, you know, racist or anything like that, and getting into a dialogue or writing that kind of a person?
Not too much. I think through just reading enough, seeing enough out there, and maybe that does go back to some of the thriller side and even what I've dealt with in the intelligence community, and you know, Joe can probably relate to the same thing. There's people have beliefs because a lot of times that's what they're just grown with. And so when you think about, or you even read, a lot of the Nazi trials, they were following orders. They were following their culture. They were following their people, their friends and stuff like that. And it's not an excuse by any means. But that's what they're consistently indoctrinated in. And so I think to remove your mindset, which is what we were taught in the intelligence community, to immerse yourself and put yourself in that culture, put yourself in that environment. What would they be thinking? What is their stimuli? I'd created a model of this for action based on social factors and psychological factors, et cetera. So it's pretty easy to say, okay, what would this person be thinking, and try to put myself in that. And I think that's where some of that historical stuff comes out. But again, tried not to put too much of that into it because I didn't want to make it like a race and a fully hate book. I did want to tell the story about this boy. So I think because it was a little bit more subtle, it was a little bit easier to do. So hopefully I pulled that off.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you do have a subtext here. You do have something you want people to take away from the book.
I do. You know, and I think it's, I don't know that it's easy to do. I don't know how anybody does, but it's that return to unconditional love for mankind. The acceptance of people as individuals and, you know, no matter what they look like, no matter what they think about, you know, can we judge them on who they are as a character? And that's why I brought in that whole aura aspect. You know, the people, including Mr. Mortimer, you know, had really dark auras. Those were not good people. Maybe those weren't things that could be changed. People that, you know, might look different, but they had that same color. They were all yellow, or they were all kind of a bright red. you know, those were people of the same ilk. And so if you could really see inside people or see on the outside of people for that aura of who they were as individuals and their true spirit, you know, I think if you can be kind of mindful of that, sometimes you can put away, you know, differences of opinions in politics, you know, social aspects, what have you. If you just know, hey, that person is kind of good at heart. And maybe that's a starting place.
There's a lot of subtext and detail and research. How long did it take you to write this thing?
It took me about 2 years, but I wasn't at it all the time. So I you know, that was kind of a cool thing about it too, is I wasn't on a deadline to knock something out in like 9 months. And I thought that was what made one of my last books not as good as it could have been, because it was kind of rushed through, didn't get a chance to do the research. There's a lot of time that, you know, I could just go for a month not writing and just thinking about the story and what was going on and take what's going on around us and add a little bit of that in to kind of pepper it. So, you know, I just took my time to be aware, be in the moment. One of my great friends from college has a son with special needs. He has Down syndrome. Jack, love this kid. And he's just the most loving, wonderful, you know, human you can imagine. And just on occasion, I think I spent probably 2-3 different times with Jack and his family as he came into town. And you know, Jack just running up and giving you the big hug. So there's a lot of like Dwight in that also. You know, we never really get deep into what, you know, Dwight's challenges are, and where they all come from and what you could attribute, because it really doesn't matter. But what I did want to hone in on is the fact that he just has that love. And I think through that, you know, that superseded any of the research, because I think when that part tugs at people's emotions, you know, for either fear or anger or what have you, you know, Dwight is a real human experience. That's not research, you know, trying to say, okay, here's are some traits and let me put this in and let's put these descriptions in, you know, that thought pattern, the words that he does say, the things that he does do. That's just what you capture by observing and being with individuals like that.
Which character do you find yourself to be in this book, or the most of you, is in?
I suspect Mr. Mortimer.
Really?
Because I think what you find, especially in the end with some reflections, you know, he's a little bit alone, a little bit of a victim of some of his circumstances. Ultimately, what he was doing, he thought was right. He was a protector by nature. Sometimes I think he could slip up and maybe exploit a situation to his own good. So I think, to be honest, if there was anybody in there, I think there could have been some of his more redeeming sides might have been to me. Maybe some of the darker sides, or maybe some of the things that I you know, can even struggle with.
Well, let's get some detail here.
Yeah, Mr. Mortimer is a creepy guy.
Yeah.
He's got a weird menu for his in the book. Food menu.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's also kind of an interesting thing too, because I think the vampire enthusiasts love seeing something that is less monstery supernatural, but can really understand how scientifically you would need to feed on marrow, feed on stem cells to regenerate. I mean, that we're dealing with that right now with research and you know, human physiology improvements, superhuman stuff. I mean, hell, there's the whole Marvel world is based on a lot of that stuff. If you think about Wolverine, Captain America, Red Skull, a lot of that took from some of those researches. And I don't think they really ever got into the depth that I've gotten into here as to what actually from a genetic standpoint you do. And I don't have any like gamma ray bullshit or anything like that in there. But it's the real experimentation that science has built off of. And I think even then casts into some of that question too of, you know, what are the benefits that we as a society have today as a result of human experimentation? You know, you feel pretty horrible about some of those stuff, even taking like a bear aspirin.
This book in itself, compared to the other ones you've written, did it have more of an effect on you? Do you find that it's changed you more than some of your other books?
I think what I like about it is it wasn't just a shoot you in the face book. And even though it's horror and I do have the satisfaction that I did want to scare people and put them through a thrill ride, I think I'm most proud of this book because I think it does give something back a little bit, or it does, it has purpose. It doesn't have just entertainment factor. I think, you know, the intelligent stuff and that, sure, I can educate people on IRGC or money laundering or whatever, but, you know, can you really use that? So, you know, I think looking back, it's like, was that more show-offy of, hey, this is what I know that you don't know? Because who's really going to build front companies? Who's going to do that? But you take a book like this, and if you can enrich your life a little bit different, see things a little bit of a different perspective, even if the only thing you walked away was to understand that there are over 500,000 Romani who were also killed. The gypsies were nearly wiped out of Europe. And you know, we focus a lot on the Jewish side of things and even some of the Poles. But how often do you hear of the Romani and even where they are today? You know, still very nomadic, don't always have homes, don't have registration, stuff like that. And so they're easily marginalized. So even just to bring a little bit more attention to a group that is still being marginalized is, I think worthwhile.
So did this book have enough impact on you that you want to do another?
Well, I'm not going to build this into a series with Mr. Mortimer, but I do have another one that I am thinking of right now. I'd say not as heavy of a theme. I was thinking of something of cross-border immigration in kind of a unique light. So about territory and trespassing, and that's the next endeavor. Now, how that comes together, I'm not exactly sure, but I don't have a problem with not writing that right away. I think just like I did this one, to sit back and marinate on it is good. I think a lot of times writers are so quick to say, I want to do this full time. Well, I don't have that luxury. But maybe the luxury is that because I've got another full-time job that I have to be focused on, I could take a little bit longer on my writing, think about it a little bit more, putting it out there. So I'm not just phoning it in like, you know, maybe some other readers or writers are forced to do because of their deadlines. Let's put some more thought into it. And I think, you know, even the writing craft, I think there were certain things I'd had a conversation with Joe not too long ago where I had a couple passages that I had written in notes and I was rereading them. I'm like, well, sometimes I just take bits and pieces of something that I've read and I put that in for a note and I'm looking at that. And I'm like, I don't think I wrote that, but I wrote it some time back, but I thought it didn't even sound kind of like me. So as I was incorporating it in, I was going through all kinds of this plagiarism review software and stuff like that, because I'm like, where the hell did I get that? Because it just felt like so from the heart. I didn't know where it came from. But and I think that by taking more time, you'll have some of those moments where, you know, maybe I put that down after having a couple glasses of wine. And I just, you know, this could be kind of a thing. I was just thinking of this and I wrote it down. And then just didn't even look at it for another month or two. And I think to have that.
How much did you drink?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you.
We're back to the drinking topic.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think we've talked about that before. I mean, when I first started writing these thrillers, I was, you know, traveling. And so you'd go out to dinner and you'd have a few drinks and, you know, you're writing late and you're still having a couple more drinks. And there's some stuff that I didn't remember exactly writing, even though I wouldn't have like blacked out, but just keeps those creative juices going. And so every now and then, I think you probably have a couple of those moments where, you know, you loosened up the inhibitions, you started free writing where it wasn't, you know, word choice. It was just a flow. And then you can kind of look at that later and it captures your heart more than I think the actual act of just writing and putting some words down.
Well, let's go with that too. I've read all your stuff and there's a different style kind of writing. I mean, the thriller stuff is bang, bang, shoot 'em up, short sentences, let's rip. This has all the stuff you would think of that descriptives.
Yeah, the atmospherics. Metaphors. Yeah.
Atmospherics. So tell me how you got into that, or how'd you make those changes, or whatever it is that you did to go from bang, bang to spooky or to the atmospheric part of it.
Well, as you know, when I got into the Bang Bang, I didn't know what I was doing with that either. And I thought I could, and I had to figure it out. This was the same thing. I was like, oh, I could just do this. And then I'm realizing I need more atmospherics. And as I would, you know, hand this off to various editors or beta readers or something, I'm like, oh, you need more atmospherics in this. I purposely didn't want to bog it down to be this 500 page novel. I think I still wanted it to be a little faster read. I think there's a lot of people that just want to read, but don't have time. And so to be able to get through a book in a few days and enjoy that, you know, I wanted to keep this at about 50,000 words, which is like the limit for a novel. And, but still have enough atmospherics that you could feel it, but that you didn't have like five pages of, you know, history of the wallpaper or something in this haunted house, or this, you know, as the leaves, you know, blew across a lawn for like five pages. I didn't want to get to that depth, but to create that mood, it took a lot. And I think that of all the books that I've written, you know, all being now this just six, but of any of the books that I've written, this is probably the one that I had to reread and rewrite the most to just kind of keep going back in there. You know, so I had the initial paint by numbers, and then I kind of painted it, and now it's kind of like smooth out the lines. Now it's kind of blur this, blend this a little bit, add a little bit of flair there. So this book, you know, even though it's a shorter read, I think it probably had a good 7, 8, 10 layers of write, rewrite, repolish, recolor it, to get it to where I think it needed to be. So really it was a contender in the space. So it met what people would expect of atmospherics. It would meet, if not exceed, I think, some of the scare and fear factor, but then add in this new kind of tempo and keep it a little bit short. And even though, you know, we could probably look back at the book and say, well, I'd like to have learned a little bit more about Mr. Mortimer, you know, when he was fleeing Poland, or when he was actually killing all these Nazis, you know, and if we could have had a few more of those, yeah, we could have, but it really wouldn't have been the same story that we wanted to tell. So, like I said, this book was written, but it was also engineered, and then it was really buffed, to get it to where I thought it needed to be. And I hope, you know, I hope enough people will read it, because I think it's something kind of special, and I think it's really something kind of innovative and unique, still within that genre.
Well, let me do an instant review. So I actually said to myself, well, there's you have a gap. You basically got World War II to present day, and I'm like, oh man, how did they, you know, all this stuff, and he's working for these guys, and he's doing this, and I say, I really would like to know that, but then I caught what you were doing. I was saying, if I got that, then all this other stuff, the present day stuff, which was really focused and important, would be lost in this historical fiction stuff. And so I think you pulled it off for me. And it's a short, it's a 2-day, 3-day read. And so I commend you for doing that kind of, you know, what I call getting rid of the purple haze kind of stuff and focusing on those major thematics, you know, the love and consequences and retribution and purpose.
Yeah. I mean, look, if I had the time and if enough people ask for it, sure, we could always write a version 2 of it, you know, that adds more to it, or have a second book that talks about, you know, the background, kind of like in Silence of the Lambs, you know, you had that background of Hannibal and going back to his youth and all that. Yeah, we could always pop one of those things out. But in the meantime, you know, hoping people will enjoy this and really embrace it for what it is. And then if we have to go back to some of the other stuff, you know, can add that in. It's not a problem.
Yeah, it's fine.
Well, when you go back to writing the spy sort of action adventure, do you think you're going to be writing different now? Has this opened up kind of a new type of writing, especially because of the, you know, your so many more descriptions going on?
Maybe a little. Maybe not, because here's the thing. I mean, the bottom line is it's a pain in the ass to keep submitting to professional review. And the stories that I was writing, I mean, they sold books, but I think it was still under like 10,000 books. So it's not like I'm making, you know, millions and say, ah, you know, this is, I just have to get lawyers and just figure out a way to do it, because it's, you know, making people happy and it's making money. It's not. So there's a lot of people who like it, but it's not a massive amount where I think I need to say, well, let's keep chasing this, because if it's not working, it's not working. Maybe I'm meant to do something else. In the meantime, I've been writing for this tactical magazine. They wanted to create some short stories. And so I took one of the characters, Drake Wolf, my main one from Task Force Orange, and I'm doing these vignettes of about 1,500 words in like four segment series. What that's doing is that's really improving my writing for like a chapter by chapter to keep it innovative, where you kind of recap and then you kind of leave it on as a cliffhanger. So that's kind of helped some of the horror. In the meantime, I think some of the horror writing that I have done has talked about or has helped me with economy of words and purpose. What do I want to achieve in a chapter or in a segment? And so being a lot more mindful instead of just kind of free writing and here it is. Now I've got 3,000 words, but if I have to keep it 1,500 words, then that's really important. And so I think by having new training now in doing that discipline, it's crossing over so that if I write a chapter, it's like, what's in that chapter? Is that chapter really meaningful? And I think I walk away from both saying, this magazine issue, it's telling exactly what I want to say, nothing more, nothing less. When I write a chapter in the horror, there's a purpose. It's not backstory. It's not all kinds of crap. There's a purpose for it. And if you read it 3 years from now, 6 years from now, you're going to get something out of it that you might have missed because it's chock full of everything that needs to go into that chapter.
So now, how do people find JT? Are you active on social media? Do you have a website? Do you have, are you on hookup apps? Like where do people find you?
And I'm all over the place trying to spread the word. So anything that you can find is under JT Patton Books. So Twitter, JT Patton Books. I think Instagram, JT Patton Books. I think I got a promo video on TikTok. The books right now are being released through Amazon because that's just one of the best distributors right now. So you can find both the paperback and then the Kindle. If people are reviewers, you can find them on all the like BookBubs and NetGalleys and all that type of stuff. So it is out there in the wind. I think all you have to really do is Google Whispers of a Gypsy and JT Patton and you'll find it. My website, jtpattonbooks.com.
And of course, we'll have all that up for people so they can find you easier. One click. They don't even have to look. So, you know, I mean, you know, what kind of reaction do you expect? And do you care about the reviews or opinions? Do you follow that up or do you stay away from those?
No, actually, I think in the past, I didn't pay much attention. In this one, I'm paying attention to it, well, largely for the fact that I don't have a ton of them, reviews coming in just yet. I mean, it was just released. But I think what I'm interested in is less about the me and more about what did the reviewer feel. And in the reviews that I've gotten so far, I've gotten exactly what I was hoping for. Somebody said it scared the shit out of me. It made me think for a few days. I sat there in shock for a while, and I want to go back and read it again in a couple months just to see if my thoughts have changed. And that's all I can ask for, because I think as for the first time, it wasn't just writing a book for the sake of writing a book, but I felt like there was a little bit, I'm not patting myself on the back or getting a big head, but I think there was a little bit of an art form to it that I was hoping people would see. And so I think when you get that review, I think what I'm hoping for is someone is to almost say, hey, thank you for seeing me and seeing what I was trying to do. And I think it's been edited enough time where some jackass isn't going to just say, there's a few typos and blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to give it 3 stars. I don't think I'm going to have that. And I'm not going to have anybody saying, that rifle really wouldn't have hit somebody at 750 yards. I think if somebody's critiquing my work, it's going to be critiquing me, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, they'll be saying that you're some sort of you're some sort of conspiracy they'll come up with for you.
Yeah. You're a mass killer.
Yeah. Yeah. You're just, you're a plant. You work for the CIA.
Don't do it.
I can see it now. So what's next? Or like you were talking about these little things, do you have any major plans, or are you just going to just kind of cruise along here?
I think we'll just keep kind of, I think we'll see a little bit of the feedback. If people like the style of writing, if they like the length and the pacing. So I'm going to be attuned to a lot of that, because if I write this next book, I think the mindset is to also have it less than $60,000. I mean, like I said, people are, or 60,000 words, I mean, people are busy. And they can't always sit down. And if you're on a vacation, you know, and you've got kids asking you this and that, you know, you just want to get through the one damn book while you're there. You can't do that with a 500 pager or a 700 pager. So I want it to be something that can be, you know, bite size in a reasonable time, or even on audio, you know, it's going to take you just a few days, not weeks and months. And if I can get that done and come up with a story, I think there's a little bit of a disruption in the industry that needs to happen. I think that's what I'm trying to do right now.
Yeah, take them down. Well,
yeah.
Hey, and it was so. One thing that's curious, just when you come up with the story, what came first? Was it your characters, or was it the actual idea behind what you were going to put these people through?
A little bit of both. I think it was the characters initially. My son likes watching The Office, and so he asked if I could name the kid Dwight. So there's a lot of things that, you know, there's kind of like on the list of things that he wanted in there that I kind of had to work around. This time I'm trying to work on something for my wife that she might have a little bit of an interest in. So, you know, I think the characters will kind of come naturally to it, to how it just has to organically actually occur. I can't force it too much. I think in the first one, you know, there were just some things about it that ended up needing to be changed later because it just didn't fit with the story. It didn't fit with the mood. And so I'm okay rewriting something like that if it just doesn't work. I'm not there to force it. And like I said, I don't have a deadline. So if it takes an extra year for it to be good, then let's wait another year.
Yeah, that's it's a big advantage. So we really appreciate you being on the show. And, of course, the new book is Whispers of a Gypsy. And this is a supernatural, dark thriller of suspense and horror. And
I recommend.
And, yeah, and Mr. Goldberg there read it, and he's still shaken.
It's spooky. But it's thought-provoking. That's kind of like my review.
Yeah.
Do you still tuck in your toes at night?
I don't want to talk about my nighttime habits.
But he's drinking a lot. He was talking about taking up whiskey now. So yeah, this is what you did.
Oh, secrets. Secrets now.
Come on. Yeah. Come on by, Joe. Come on by.
Oh, yeah. That's right. You're the expert. You're the connoisseur.
He's the connoisseur. Well, Mr. J.T. Patton, we wish you luck. And, again, thank you for, you know, coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. And thanks, Joe, for your thought-provoking questions. Appreciate you taking the time to read that, too.
Thanks. You're welcome.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.